Curtis Lewa.
Two young people decided to form their own organization called the Guardian Angels. You see them with red berets. When you see them, you get a nice, secure feeling in your heart.
I admire Curtis Lewa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
Curtis Lewa, the Guardian Angels founder and leader.
We've got Curtis Lewa from WABC Radio.
Curtis Lewa, legendary New Yorker.
Drive at 5 with Curtis Lewa. What happened today? Why? And what's next? Live, local, on it. 77 WABC.
Seven minutes after the hour of five, as we're high atop Madison Square Garden and the great facilities provided to us for this broadcast by NJDiet.com. And there's a lot of El Rapido activity in the White House. First off, Kislyak, you remember him. He's the Russian ambassador that nobody ever admitted meeting with. No, not Kushner. Not the attorney general, not anybody. Nobody ever met with Kislyak. Well, anyway, the ambassador of Russia, who nobody ever met with, is now being recalled to Moscow. And years ago, that would have meant a KGB agent met you at the airport, took you on a ride, put two bullets in the back of your head, and you disappeared into the ether. That won't happen with Kislyak. He'll probably be rewarded with the nation's highest prize for bamboozling so many Americans. That's one point. Then you got Mitch McConnell, who is all hands on deck as he tries to get the Republican Senate version passed before the July 4th break. And it seems there are cracks on both sides of his conservative support and moderate support within the Republican Party. But there was a moment, though, that the president of the United States, Donald Trump, took to dance the hora and the tarantella as he declared victory, because the United States Supreme Court said it would hear arguments on his travel ban in October, but said temporarily they would clear the way to prohibit the entry of some people into the United States from the countries that he deemed dangerous. On the line to discuss that is Deborah Perlstein, Associate Professor of Constitutional and International Law at Cardozo School of Law. Thanks for joining us here on the Drive Home at 5, Deborah.
Pleasure to be here.
Okay, so from the beginning, this program of Donald Trump has been filled with problems, objected to on almost every measure along the way at every level of the federal court system. Was the president right in declaring victory today of his travel restrictions?
No. I think the president's a little premature in declaring victory. And in fact, the order the court issued today is pretty limited in a couple of important respects. Most important, it just doesn't weigh in on the merits one way or another if the president's ban was legal or not. Was it unconstitutional? Did it exceed its statutory authority? The court's order doesn't answer any of those questions. It simply says, we're going to review this case, and while the case is pending, part of the order can take effect, but it's a pretty narrow part.
And what part of that order would take effect until the court will hear all the arguments?
So what the court says is that for anybody who has a credible claim of a bona fide relationship with a person or entity in the United States, in other words, if you have family here, or if you're a student in a university here, or if you have some other business relationship here, this ban still cannot extend to you. But if you have no previous relationship with the United States at all, then, and you're from one of the six Muslim majority countries that the president's order identifies, then the order can extend to cover you, at least pending the court's decision to hear the case.
Well, I'm looking at it not in either a pro-Trump viewpoint or an anti-Trump viewpoint, but wouldn't this be a good model to just continue on without it having to be fully resolved? This seems to be very Solomon-like in giving a part of the opportunity for people to come to the country who qualify, and for those who don't, you're on the outside looking in.
It is sort of a Solomonic order in a variety of ways. It really splits the baby, and it reads as though it was negotiated carefully by the six justices who joined it. The problem with the problem with reading too much into it, I think, is that at some point soon, in the next few months, something else is going to happen. And the reason for that is the order itself that's been challenged so much says the administration wants 90 days to review immigration procedures, right? We're going to impose this ban for 90 days, and that'll give us a chance to figure out whether our existing vetting procedures are adequate. Well, those 90 days are going to expire before the case hits the court, sometime after the first Monday in October. And the court asks the parties to tell it, when the case comes to it in the fall, why this case by then won't be moot. That is, the president's order itself only lasts for 90 days. That time period is going to run before the court takes it, and the court is enormously likely to say, if the president takes no further action between now and then, you know what? There's no basis for us to hear this case anymore. Your order has expired. So it may well be the court just never gets to the merits of whether or not the president's order is constitutional or not. The other possibility is that the president does take some further action between now and October. He issues a new order or takes some other kind of action that raises different questions. But if that's the case, then the court may well simply vacate the case it just granted and allow the lower courts to evaluate the legality of whatever the new order is. In other words, it's far from clear the court's ever going to get to this particular order on the merits of the constitutional question.
Well, you know, I'm just looking at the countries involved, Iraq having been removed from initially appearing on the list. But many of these countries are torn up by civil war. There is no administration. There is no dependable bureaucracy. It would be kind of difficult to check anybody's credentials. Seems to make common sense that these countries would be picked out, especially since they had been picked out during the Barack Obama administration. Is it all about the words that the president used during the campaign and his reference to Giuliani to check to see the validity of what a Muslim ban would involve?
The lower courts held the ban illegal for two different reasons. One court said this is a violation of the Establishment Clause of the Constitution. That is, it's an exercise in religious discrimination. And we can tell that not only because of what the president said, but what his aides said, and what the president continued to say after the order was written and was revised. In other words, the president himself said, we're doing this to keep certain religious minority outside the United States, and in the initial order, at least, said we're going to try to maintain a preference for other religious minorities to enter the United States. So that's the kind of thing that the Constitution itself squarely prohibits, and that's the reason at least one of the courts was so worried about the discriminatory effect of the ban. The other reason that the other court decided that also held the ban unlawful was that the president said he was doing this for national security reasons. But there were multiple problems with buying the president's explanation that he thought national security was actually at stake. For one thing, the initial order was issued far too fast for the administration to have done any sort of review to make any sort of serious determination about whether there was a national security problem here. And indeed, the existing vetting procedures from these countries, these and other countries, were enormously rigorous as it was. After the initial order was issued, it became clear that indeed the intelligence agencies and the Department of Homeland Security and others thought that not only would a ban of this nature not help national security, it would actually compromise national security. So to the extent the president wanted to rely on the national security expertise of the executive branch in defending the ban, the executive branch experts in national security wouldn't stand behind the president's order. And it was for that reason and the stated reasons the president had given that the courts were so skeptical that national security was really what was driving the president's order.
You appreciate that. Deborah Perlstein, associate professor of constitutional and international law at Cardozo School of Law. Seems to me that as the Supreme Court has pushed off its final decision to October, that this is like a jump ball, right? It's Donald Trump versus any of his adversaries, a jump ball. It's like a tie game. It's like you're going into overtime, and depending on what happens, who gets the first touch of the ball, that person may well end up winning in the course of their arguments in finality. And if the president obviously takes to Twitter and then starts condemning members of the American Civil Liberties Union and others who are challenging him on that, that could all of a sudden change the tone of the court's decision. So you would think the president would just cool his jets, not tweet about this, and just be satisfied that he got half of what he wanted instead of the whole pie. But you know Donald Trump. He will never be satisfied unless he wins.
Curtis Sliwa.
The next mayor of the city of New York.
The Drive at 5.
Curtis Sliwa, legendary New Yorker.
77 WABC.
As we continue here on the drive home at 5, and that's exactly what the outgoing jail boss, Commissioner of the Department of Corrections, Joseph Pontes, claimed when he was making those excursions up to his palazzo, his Ponderosa up in Maine, that he was working overtime kind of hours, you know, like almost 12 hours a day. You would think we'd have been rid of this guy, this gold brick, this slacker, this guy who was just siphoning off money while there was chaos in the jail system. But we really haven't visited this story much of late because we've been gripped in covering the collapse of the transit system, especially our subway system, and mayoral control of the public school system, which might be determined by the end of this week as to who will be in charge of the Department of Education, the DOE, dumbest organization ever, or if we revert to the old Board of Education. But on the line now to discuss this main drag, as the Daily News calls it, is Reuven Blau, reporter for the New York Daily News, New York's hometown newspaper. We've had him before on many Rikers Island issues. Thanks for joining us, Reuven, here on the Drive at 5.
Hey, Curtis. Thanks for having me.
So give me an idea of what Joseph Pontes is now claiming he was doing when he was making those joints up to Maine, and still billing the taxpayers by claiming he was actually working and not vacationing.
So he says that he spent over 90 days out of state last year. That was according to a Department of Investigation report released in August. And we did a little research, and we filed a Freedom of Information Law request for his timesheets, and it showed that he had put in for 11 and a half hour days multiple times during those excursions to Maine. And, you know, the question is, like, why? And it essentially is because supervisors, including commissioners, are entitled to kind of stockpile their vacation time. And when they leave, they can use that for a lump sum payment, which he is likely planning to do. And he's going to cash out for at least about $20,000, when he retires and leaves on Wednesday.
You're kidding. So in addition to leaving us high and dry and not doing the job that he was supposed to do by being away so much, he's going to leave with a parachute for work that he claims was done while he was in Maine?
Exactly. Yeah. The hours are still being investigated by DOI, and, you know, sort of it remains unclear, you know, what, you know, if he will sort of get that time. But yeah, I mean, it definitely, you know, he's put in for it, and he says, hey, you know, I was in Maine, but, you know, over time I was working, you know, 11 and a half hours days when I was there at this sort of really, you know, nice area, nice house that he has there, this Victorian four bedroom home that overlooks this, this river.
Boy, he's got a big set. What could you be doing in 11 and a half hours? Was he Skyping? Was he doing FaceTime Live? I mean, how was he dealing with all the crisis situations that were taking place on the Rock, Rikers Island, during his regime? How could he do that by phone or by email or by modern technology?
I mean, that's a $1 million question. The city has a policy for managers that they have to sort of be on site. They do have exceptions. You know, each agency sort of can map out their own exceptions. And when it comes to DOC, the Department of Correction, there actually is no policy about telecommuting. So it defers to the manager, and he, as a commissioner, is the ultimate manager, meaning he can, you know, could do whatever he wants, essentially, and work from wherever he wants to be.
Now, Reuven, you've been on Rikers Island, right?
Yes.
You know, they have a little house there on Rikers Island. I don't think they use it, but it was originally built for the purpose that whoever was in charge of Rikers Island, whoever was in charge of the correctional department, would have a place to live right on the island. Very similar to like the chancellor of a university might have a chancellor's house, you know, on the campus of the college. Do you know if anybody actually uses that house?
I do not. That is a really good question. I do know that some people, especially like, you know, when there's a big storm coming, they'll, you know, do really long shifts, and there are places, there's trailers all over the island, you know, different offices that people have that they can sort of stay overnight if necessary.
Okay, now when is he officially gone out of our hair so we can get on with our lives and try to figure out what to do with the mess at Rikers and throughout the correctional department?
This Wednesday is his last day in office.
All right, and do we have any potential replacements? Because I'm amazed here. I'm looking at Pont, who is like a part-time correctional chief of the largest municipal jailing system in America with major problems all the time. We've been told by the governor that Joe Loder is going to repair the subway system that's falling apart as we speak as a part-time manager who's still going to be spending most of his time over at NYU Hospital as a vice president there. Are we actually looking for somebody who is going to actually sit down, cop a squat, and do the job of the correctional department chief?
Yeah, so I've reported that there, City Hall has been looking at least two candidates that I know of. One is the latest one being mentioned is somebody, Vincent Schiraldi. He is the former head of the city probation department, and he had close ties to Elizabeth Glazer, who's the head of the mayor's office of criminal justice. He's currently actually in Boston, but working as a senior research fellow at Harvard University, but he's coming back to New York, and he's expressed interest and has been interviewed by City Hall multiple times.
All right, but he's run probation. He's never run in jail.
Correct, correct.
Do we have anybody who actually knows how to run a jail that's in consideration?
As far as I know, no. There's another person who's the former head of the prison system in Washington, Dan Pacholke, who is the former boss there, and he's also been interviewed, but that was a prison system, and it's a little different than Rikers. I mean, I think Rikers is a very sort of unique beast.
What is going on there now? Because I know it's not in the news cycle, Reuven, but there's always problems, whether it's with the correctional department personnel or the inmates themselves or the management. Because, you know, it just hasn't surfaced because so much of the other news is about mayoral control and the collapse of the subway system. But what is going on there in this day-to-day situation that was just a month ago completely out of control?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question on the broad front. You know, the real challenge is stemming the violence. There's been an increase in stabbings and slashings. It's been continually going up over the last several years, and the department has really struggled. The city's really struggled with how to stop that violence. You know, they say that it's a small number of inmates who are sort of contributing to the big picture and the big problem, and they're really struggling with how to handle them. Like in the past, they'd, you know, kind of use extreme isolation and solitary, and they put really strong restrictions against that in place, and as a result have really struggled, largely, you know, that's been a major factor in some of the struggles with how to sort of contain the violence.
Well, do appreciate that. Reuven Blah, reporter for New York's hometown newspaper, The Daily News. His beat is corrections, especially Rikers Island. But isn't it amazing that out of the two candidates interviewed to replace Pont, the deadbeat, the slacker, a guy who's siphoning our tax dollars, not one of these candidates has ever run a jail system. So it's almost like, hey, we'll put him in charge of the jail system and maybe he'll learn through experience. Meantime, we have Joe Loder being assigned by the governor to repair a subway system that is in massive disrepair, and he's doing it as a part-timer. What kind of emergency? We got an emergency in the correctional department, an emergency in Rikers Island, an emergency with the subway system, and this is like we're just patching it up with Bazooka Joe bubblegum here. One of these officials going to get serious about these scenarios that are unfolding in front of us, and they can't even find capable personnel who have run a correctional facility in a major urban area to come to New York City? I just don't buy that. I just think it's Comrade Bill de Blasio who wants to maintain control. And you know what that means? His control is our chaos.
Curtis Lewa.
Really trying to help our cause.
The Drive at 5.
We're very honored to have him here today.
77 WABC.
Oh, it's the Schwitzer times when you're stuck in a subway car, air conditioning not working. That's a bad sign. And now, all of a sudden, there's faulty electricity or some kind of signal problems, and it puts you in the middle of a tunnel. And now, all of a sudden, there's an insurrection. You've been there 15 minutes, and you get these messages. And that's all you get. And then, all of a sudden, the lights flicker on and off. And now, you're gasping for air. So, one of the passengers decides, hey, it's time to abandon our subway car. Follow me. Get down on the tracks. Let's walk up to the next station. And this is now happening increasingly. And the MTA is saying, you better not. It's not only dangerous, but we may have to crack down on this. While the MTA is threatening passengers who abandon their subway car in the middle of a tunnel or before they reach their station, there is another strap hanger, Michael Sheraffo, who's actually calling for certain evacuation protocol. And we welcome him here to the Drive Home at 5. Thanks for jumping on board, Michael.
My pleasure, Curtis. Thank you for having me.
All right, so now, what makes you an expert here? Were you actually stuck yourself on a subway that was in between stations or in a tunnel?
Yes, I was on the F train from hell 3 weeks ago on this very day. We got stuck in a tunnel between West 4th and Broadway Lafayette for 45 minutes. We were lied to by the MTA, who told us that train traffic was ahead of us. Meanwhile, there's no lights, no air conditioning, no air, and it's about 120 degrees. People started taking off all their clothes, dripping sweat on the floor. We began to crack open the windows and try to get the doors open, only to find that they were all locked, and we were suffocating. Luckily, they got us into the station in time before anybody was injured or hurt, and we then had to wait an additional 10 minutes for them to open the doors to clear the platform while we suffered and clawed at the doors begging to get out.
Now, Michael Sheraffo, if you had in fact been on a different train in which you could actually go from subway car to subway car between cars because the doors open, do you think if it weren't the F train, but maybe, let's say, example, the C train, where you can do that, that some of your fellow passengers at that time might have actually abandoned their subway car and sought an attempt to walk on the tracks on their own to the next station?
I can't speak for everyone else. I would tell you that I would bet not. People were very afraid and scared. One thing I want to make clear is we were not looking to go run through the tunnel. We simply wanted to open the doors and the windows to breathe air. This is a different situation than most train delays. Imagine you're a rider on the train and you find yourself in a position where you feel it's necessary to start stripping off your clothes. What adult New Yorker would think of doing such a thing unless it was so desperately hot that you had to start getting naked?
Okay, well, you've
gone. What I'm talking about.
You've gone public. You've positioned these papers on your own social networking site. Have you gotten any response from the MTA, which seems to be in crisis mode now?
I have not. I just mailed the letters out 15 minutes ago, so they don't have them yet. I'm pretty sure they're aware they're on their way, given the publicity we got today. But one thing's for certain. They're not going to be able to get out of this one. This time, they're not going to be able to brush things under the rug and lie to the public. There's only one solution here. The MTA must take a page from the Washington Metro station and have diagrams, pamphlets, and ad campaigns, much like the See Something, Say Something, so that New Yorkers know what to do in the event of a subway situation emergency. Now, the other thing is this. They don't want people walking off on the trains, off into the subways by themselves because it's a danger. However, if you're stuck on a subway train, locked in and cannot breathe, and you're being lied to about it, what honesty should I have? What trust should I place in the MTA to save my life? Clearly, to them, we're just lawsuits waiting to happen. So what I am saying is riders should have the right to rescue themselves in the event of an emergency if it ever happens. Currently, our subway system is designed to to not allow a rioter to take their life in their own hands. We put our lives into the trust of the MTA, which no one holds trustworthy these days. So I ask all listeners, would you trust your life in the hands of the MTA? I don't think so.
No, you're absolutely correct, Michael Schiraffo. And in fact, we'll stay in touch with you to see if the paperwork that you forwarded to the money-taking agency, the MTA, actually gets responded to or just ends up being filed in the round filing cabinet, which so often happens in that massive bureaucracy. Or maybe the Mashiach, you know, the savior, Joe Loda. Mr. Part-Time, believe it or not, this guy's going to save the subway system and he's only going to work at it part-time. Boy, he's quite the Mashiach, right? Maybe he can turn water into wine. You know, maybe he can raise people from the dead like the Lazarus is out there. Get out of here. It's all a public relations ploy. But unlike Michael, I'm telling all of you, having walked through the subways and through the tunnels and on the tracks before and having abandoned subway cars that were not moving, it's a lot safer than you think. Now, obviously, I'm like my baptism in fire was in the subways. I wouldn't advise to everyone that they abandon their subway cars and they start walking through the tracks. It's not as dangerous as the MTA says. You're not going to hit that third rail. And no, if in the course of working to the next station, all of a sudden you have the urge to relieve yourself, if all of a sudden you do that, right, and you hit the third rail, don't believe the old wives' tale that the conduit of electricity through the liquid that you're emitting is going to somehow electrocute you, and all of a sudden you're going to be like toast. Don't believe that. Trust me, I've done it many times. And if you have to do it, if you have to abandon your subway car, go for it. Because if you're going to wait for the MTA to come rescue you, you're going to be waiting for a month of Sundays.
Imus in the morning.
So far, so good.
And the drive at 5.
There are so many ways to do it.
On air. Online. On the app.
That's unbelievable.
77 WABC.
Five 54 as we continue on the drive home at 5. One of my favorite topics about the geriatric espresso sipping psychotic killers of organized crime. And oh boy, does John Sonny Francisi fit that bill. At the age of 100, Colombo crime family member worked his way all the way up to the underboss, has been released from a Massachusetts federal lockup. After six different times that he ended up doing time for assault, bank robberies, and a lot of parole violations, but never for what he was most known for, murder. Think of it. Back in 1942, in the midst of World War II, he's in the Army. He's discharged from the United States Army because he displayed homicidal tendencies, right? You want that, to kill the Japs, right? Kill the Nazis. He was so crazy. He was such a psychopathic killer that he couldn't even be used by the Army to fight the Japs in the Pacific or the Nazis in the Atlantic. So then he comes home, and naturally he starts building his resume. 50 killings on his watch alone. And how do we know he killed 50? Because he was caught on a wire with a cooperator in which he was telling the guy that in order not to get detected, because he never got arrested for any of the 50 murders he was responsible for, he put nail polish on his fingertips before murder to avoid leaving fingerprints at the crime scene. He also would wear a hairnet during the murder so as to avoid leaving any hair strands at the crime scene so they couldn't analyze his DNA. And his procedure later was to dismember the corpse in a kiddie pool, dry the severed body parts in a microwave oven, and then run the parts through a commercial-grade garbage disposal, saying to the cooperator on the phone, "Today you can't have a body no more. It's better to take the extra half hour or an hour to get rid of the body than it is to leave the body on the street." Oh, what a 50 murders! So then finally, back in 2010, he's on trial for shaking down strip clubs and jiggle joints and pizza parlors. The guy is like 90 years old and he's shaking down pizza parlors and jiggle joints. And so he's outside of the court and he's doing one-handed sit-ups one-handed sit-ups and then one-handed push-ups. And then all of a sudden, everyone's saying, this guy is physically fit. The next thing you know, his wife, Christina, is taking him in for the trial in a wheelchair. And she sees that sitting in the aisle next to her is his kumada. The guy has a kumada in his 90s. She takes out a shiv, Christina, and she tries to stab him. And then during the sentencing, the defense attorney says, Christina, his beloved wife, would like to take him home. He's too old. His own grandchild stood up and said, send him to jail. If you send him home with his wife, she's going to kill him. And so he went to jail. And now he's out and people are saying, oh, come on, he's 100 years old. The guy killed 50 people and never did time for murder. And people are actually showing up at his house with a little bit of espresso and biscuits for his 100th birthday. Oofah.